What's it like being a street artist? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, his work is well known throughout Miami and now in different parts of the world. He's known as Atomic, and you've seen the street art of Obi, the Smiling Orange. We're going to talk to him about what it's like going from a street artist to an established member of the gallery art community. Also, there's a committee in Miami that's responsible for tackling climate change issues. There are millions to spend, but how will the members decide to use all that money? Finally, the Florida Supreme Court is no stranger to having cameras in the courtroom. They were one of the first courts to allow cameras back in the 1970s. The court has set another new precedent. The justices now stream their hearings on Facebook Live. We'll talk with the Chief Justice about why this is a big deal. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Miami's Sea Level Rise Committee helps city officials who are trying to figure out how to spend some of the $400 million that was part of a bond taxpayers agreed to last year. The idea is to help Miami develop plans and city codes that inclusively and equitably prepare for rising seas. But an activist who was invited to speak at last week's meeting ended up being berated by a committee member. We're joined now by WLRN's Kate Stein, who covers environmental issues. Kate, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by this. Let's remind everybody, what is this committee again?
So the Miami Sea Level Rise Committee was created in 2015, and it helps city officials, city commissioners plan for sea level rise. You know, things like ordinances, code changes, any sorts of resolutions that they might be taking. And that means it's potentially influential in how some of that money from the $400 million Miami Forever bond might be allocated.
They're not making up any rules or setting up policy. They're just advising.
They're advising. Right?
Okay. Who's on this committee?
So it's a mix of resilience officials from Miami-Dade County and a lot of people from the community, architects, scientists, members of community groups who are volunteering their time to advise once a month. They meet once a month and work on. These are maybe things that that the city commissioners should be thinking about.
And how are they chosen? How was this committee put together?
They're appointed.
They're appointed. Mm-hmm. By who?
I'm not sure who they're appointed by, but I think it's through the City Resilience Office. And so there are 9 committee members formally, on the committee, and 8 of them are men, which sort of gets to the controversy that emerged last week.
Let's talk about that controversy in a second. Real quickly, remind people, too, about the Miami Forever bond.
Right. So it's a $400 million bond that voters passed last year. $192 million of that goes to sea level rise, adaptations, preparations. The rest of the money is for things like affordable housing. There's some money for parks and cultural centers. And the city is still working on exactly how the money will be allocated. But basically, there's a bucket of $192 million or so that's allocated for sea level rise preparations.
So they're having these meetings, and they want to hear from the public on ideas, right, on how to spend this money.
Yeah, I mean, the meetings are open to the public. A lot of the time, it's mostly committee members who are there, talking with each other and formulating ideas, but certainly the public is invited to chime in, and they have public comment periods.
And they had a public comment period last week, and someone stepped up to the mic, and then all of a sudden, one of the committee members started to berate this particular woman. Take us through who's involved and what happened.
Right. So I wouldn't say it was all of a sudden necessarily. The woman who was involved in this, her name is Maggie Fernandez, and she is an activist with the Miami Climate Alliance. And she was invited to, which the Miami Climate Alliance is a coalition of local climate and community groups. And Maggie was invited to speak by one of the committee members to talk about a proposal that, or a project that the Miami Climate Alliance is working on, which is a campaign that they're doing to try to engage community members around sea level rise and climate change, especially climate change, not just sea level rise.
So she came up and she started talking. What did she say to them?
So she gave her presentation, and she was talking about how the members of the Climate Alliance would like the city of Miami to consider some sort of climate liability tracking sort of thing, where they look at how you know, who's responsible and how much is it costing the city of Miami? How much is climate change costing the city and the communities here? So she gave that presentation, and then later on during the public comment period, she returned to speak before the commission again, and she was talking about being frustrated with what she perceives as a slow pace on sea level rise and climate issues. And she was also concerned about the lack of diversity as she sees it on the Sea Level Rise Committee.
Because it's mostly men?
It's right. The list that I got from the city of Miami is that it's 9 committee members, 8 of whom are men. The one woman on the committee is, I believe, also the one black member.
Did she also talk about, or someone else had brought up this idea of possibly going after oil companies and some of the fossil fuel companies, maybe in lawsuits to try to get some of that money or try to get to pay for sea level rise climate change issues?
My understanding is no. I think that's where some of the confusion lies in some of the other reporting that's gone on around this. What I understand is that Maggie came and spoke mostly just to put this idea forward that the city needs to be tracking, you know, how much it's costing, how much climate change is costing the community. And then that would presumably be part of maybe some sort of resolution or something going forward. But basically, as part of this campaign that she wants the committee to get on board with supporting, the pay up for sea level rise campaign, pay up for climate change campaign that she's working on, she wants the city to have some numbers about, you know, how much is it costing us.
All right. So who on the committee went after her and what they do?
So one of the committee members is a architect named Reynaldo Borges. He's pretty well respected as someone who thinks about, you know, the future and what architects can do to help Miami prepare for sea level rise. And during the public comment period, after Maggie made her comments, or as she was making her comments, I think he began to feel pretty offended by the idea that the committee hasn't made that much progress, because he personally, and, you know, from my reporting and from having worked with him a time or two, I know he's put a lot of time and a lot of effort into thinking about what the city can do. And I think sort of, so he got into this exchange with Maggie where she felt berated. She described it as being at the point of tears, basically. And part of this, too, was because she had asked him to stop, you know, mansplaining to her. So she felt that she was being talked over. She felt that her voice was not being heard. And there was a pretty heated back and forth that surprised and, I think, kind of appalled a lot of the people who were in the room.
All right. So what does this mean for, well, what does it mean for, you know, Mr. Borges? What does it mean for Maggie? What does it mean for the committee?
So it's not clear what this means for Mr. Borges in particular. And I'm sorry, I don't know if he says his name Borges or Borges. So apologies if I'm not getting the pronunciation correct. I was not actually at this meeting. But it's not clear. The committee chairman hasn't taken any action such as removing him from the committee yet. So it remains to be seen. He has reached out to Maggie to try to apologize. I've talked with both him and Maggie. And it sounds like basically what this comes down to is a conflict of what exactly the committee's role is and what, because climate change is a huge issue, right? And so Maggie's position is that, you know, we need to get people on board with, you know, pushing back against the big corporations and, you know, the polluters who are causing this problem. And I think Reynaldo feels much more like, you know, in the city of Miami, that's too big of a challenge for us to take on. We need to be looking at how we can help our city and our neighborhoods prepare for potentially 2 feet of sea level rise within the next 40 years, which is huge when you think about that. So it's kind of, you know, obviously he's a very apologetic for having pushed too hard. And I think that going forward, the committee will definitely need to take a look at whether it's fulfilling its mission of being inclusive and equitable in the way it plans for sea level rise. So there are important conversations happening around that. But I think it comes down to just sort of looking at how are we addressing sea level rise as a community? It's this huge problem. Is it just one or the other? We focus on national attention. It's not, you know, it's not just national attention to the issue or, you know, adapting and preparing with infrastructure, with seawalls, with, you know, changing the architecture of buildings. It's got to be both. And so I think that's what the committee will be talking about as a result of this.
And they're going to keep having these meetings, though, right? Nothing's changed in that sense.
As far as I know, nothing's changed. They have meetings scheduled every month. The Miami Climate Alliance has calls, I think, every week. Not sure about that, but pretty routinely to work on their you know, their plans for this social media campaign and the campaign that they're embarking on. And so, you know, hopefully going forward, this will draw a lot more attention and hopefully encourage dialogue between the city and the Sea Level Rise Committee and the Climate Alliance people who are working on this.
That's WLRN's Kate Stein. She covers environmental issues for us, as well as many other things as well. Kate, is always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet one of Miami's most prodigious street artists. I could say that. Atomic is in the house. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. So what is Miami known for? Is it Cuban coffee, the roosters that you see from time to time in communities, hard bodies on the beach? What about Obi? You know Obi. He's that recognizable face painted on walls, buildings, freight cars all throughout Miami. He's that smiling orange that's everywhere. The artist behind the image is known as Atomic, one of Miami's most established street artists, and he joins us now in studio. Atomic, is such a pleasure. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? Clear something up for me. We were having this discussion earlier in the newsroom, and is it street artist or is it graffiti artist?
I started as a graffiti artist, and then when I made the transition from writing my name to painting the orange, I was considered a street artist.
So what's the difference between a graffiti artist and a street artist?
I think that graffiti is mostly name-based, and it's just a personal thing. Street art is more about sending a message or painting a pretty picture or something along those lines.
So it's not an insult when you call somebody a graffiti artist if they're a street artist, no?
No, not at all. But I think the other way around, graffiti writers will be offended if they're called street artists.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. In case I run into anybody, I don't say the wrong thing. You're a Miami guy. You started here. You've lived here all your life.
Correct.
How did it start for you?
Well, just seeing graffiti in my neighborhood and having a talent towards art and also being outgoing and running around, climbing on stuff, those three things kind of merged to keep me in touch with the arts.
What's the first time that I guess you took? Is it always with spray cans, by the way?
The majority of the times, yes. You could use a marker. But the first time I used a spray can, I was in maybe like fourth or fifth grade. My friend went to Columbia and left some paint behind the store, the convenience store right by my house. And I went into his stash and spray painted on the back of the store.
All right. And so then I wonder, like, when did you decide that this is something you wanted to do, like, a lot? That it wasn't just something you were just having some fun with?
I'd say junior high school leading into high school was when I got comfortable with the spray can and really was engulfed in the craft of graffiti.
Is it about, whether it's street art or graffiti art, you know, is it about the challenge of finding a place where you can put your art? And I don't know, is it called tagging? Is that what it is?
Yeah, tagging or painting, bombing or getting up or... Yeah.
Okay, I'm learning a lot today. But is it about, you know, is it the challenge of finding the spot that is off limits? Is that what it's all about? Finding the place that you're not supposed to be and really defacing a place? I mean, some people will call it that, but is that what it's all about, that challenge?
Correct, yeah. I think the higher you paint, the better.
So, the higher up.
Yeah, when people paint on highway signs or billboards or rooftops, there's more of a shock value to it. So, yeah, there's definitely a better, like...
All right, so what's the first time that you got up somewhere really high? What was that place?
I think painting along the metro rail, just doing rooftops. That was the first time that I've painted off the ground, yeah.
You ever run into the people whose buildings or property that you had, you know, painted on that you had tagged, I guess as it's called?
I have, yeah. Okay. Sometimes they're stoked and sometimes they're not.
Okay, wait a minute. So sometimes they're happy that you did it?
Yeah. Sometimes people will contact me and ask me to do a full-fledged mural on a place that I actually vandalized.
Okay, tell me about the times, though. Then they were not too happy. And did you ever have a confrontation?
Well, I was doing a festival recently, the Carnival on the Mile, and a gentleman told me that I tagged his new construction, his new building in Wynwood, and he wasn't very happy about it. And yeah, I didn't really know what to say. I kind of like got my guard up and said, "Well, I'm gonna go back," or whatever he said. I bet you won't, but yeah, I've.
Has it ever gotten, you know, like beyond just an argument, or, you know?
No, it's never been physical. No, I've never gotten into a fight over painting a property.
But you've been arrested a few times in life, right?
Yes.
All right. I want to get to that a little bit about, you know, just that process for you and when you're tagging a place and when you're picking out a place. You have formal training as an artist. You went to school for this.
I did magnet school in junior high, and I did AP classes in high school, and then I studied graphic design. I got my bachelor's degree.
So at what point, because I'm trying to figure out, like, at what point did you decide, like, because you could have gone a very traditional path as an artist, and, you know, whether it was a graphic designer working on ads or something, or, you know, just running your own studio, but you're still holding on to this life that you had, you know, as I guess back then as a graffiti artist and a street artist. But I mean, you know, how did you try to balance the two out? Did you ever think I should go this way instead of that way?
I think I made the decision to pursue art full time after working in an office behind a computer desk.
Oh, you had a regular 9-to-5 job?
Yeah, I was doing that, and I couldn't do it anymore. So then I just started freelancing, and that was around the time that I started the Orange campaign. So it allowed me to have a career in art. You know, people were receptive to the character I was painting, and I'm able to.
Did your parents know about, you know, some of the stuff that you had been doing?
Yeah, they
When you were doing graffiti and street art, they knew about it?
Originally, they supported it, and they were buying books and materials and stuff. And after I got kicked out of summer school in junior high, that's when it hit the fan. They tore up. They made me tear up all of my, you know, sketchbooks and threw all my markers away and whatnot. So they weren't too supportive after, you know, getting kicked out of school and getting arrested and getting into fights and whatnot. But, you know, 20 years down the road, they're happy that I continued to paint.
I gotta ask, what happened in summer school? What did you do?
I tagged the fence across the street, and then another student like got into trouble and ratted on a bunch of the students there. So they kicked me out, and they had me go over there and clean the fence. And yeah.
I've always found, you know, talking to graffiti artists and street artists about the process, but talking specifically about tagging was really fascinating, because my understanding is, so one, you got to find the right place. How do you do that?
I think it's just a matter of visual, of people being able to see your name or what you're painting.
So you want to go higher. You always want to go higher.
Yeah, higher, or just right smack in front of someone's face, whether it's on a bus or on a wall, just somewhere in the line of sight.
Is when you're looking for a place, though, is the place, if it's off limits, if you see no trespassing signs, or, you know, if there's specific areas that are just more appealing because maybe there's a risk and danger, or are there any places that are off limits even to you?
Well, I don't like to paint on government property or federal property. I don't think it's a good idea to paint churches or someone's house. But anything other than that is fair game, you know. But, yeah, I'd like to paint higher spots and to paint trains that will move from my city and go all around the country or possibly into other countries. But, yeah.
You've traveled internationally. I do want to ask you about that. You, early on in your career, many years ago, you were part of a group here in South Florida, in Miami. Mm-hmm. MSG, is that what it's called?
Yes.
What was MSG?
MSG is basically a collective of graffiti artists and graffiti writers. And I'm maybe like second or third generation. They started in the early 90s. And I was asked to be a part of the crew in, I want to say, early 2000s. So,
and what kind of stuff were you guys doing?
Well, MSG has always been known for bombing. That's one thing. They used to really paint a lot of the highways and whatnot and the highway signs. But aside from that, they would also do full-fledged productions and murals that were more than just your name and letters. They would put characters and backgrounds and have a theme.
And so what's it like being part of a group like this? I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm thinking of, like, is this some kind of club and there's an expectation on you or, you know, a rules about how you're allowed to behave?
Well, a lot of people are afraid of crews. They think it's like a gang. But when it comes to MSG, it's not a gang at all. It's just a chill group of guys, really. We don't have any requirements as to how much you have to paint. I mean, you have to put out some work and have a certain level of skill to be in the crew. But, yeah, we meet up, you know, once a week. I'll open up my studio and have my friends come over. And some of them are in the crew, some of them aren't. But we meet regularly and hang out and just draw or paint, party, whatever.
I heard, again, other street artists I've known is that there is a level of territorialism. Like, this is your territory, this is their territory, and you don't cross. Is that the case with graffiti artists, street artists? Like, they're just places you don't go because that's another group.
Not here in Miami. Maybe in the 80s and early 90s when there was a gang presence. But these days, there's not a territory issue.
Now, but I'd read a little bit, help me understand the story, with you and MSG. Was there an issue with territory or another group? Was there a fight between two groups?
Well, there's beefs between writers. And, I've had, you know, my fair share of beef and fights and whatnot. But it's not based on, oh, you're, you know, this crew and we're rivals or whatever, so instantly we fight. It's more of like a personal thing.
Help me understand, how is Miami seen compared to what you see in, I guess, the cities that are synonymous with graffiti and street art? New York, L.A., things like that. Where's Miami on the map?
Well, Miami has always had a rich graffiti culture. It was never really on the street where you saw it much. It would always be in abandoned buildings or track sides. But now with Wynwood, in the last like 10, 15 years, it's the scene in Miami has become one of the sought out cities to paint. It's
this is the place people want to come to.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of people from all over the world come to Wynwood and Miami and paint.
All right, I want to get to Wynwood as well. So I got to get to. There's so many things here with you. I want to talk about. Again, I'm talking with a Miamian artist. He's known as Atomic, a street artist. As he said, he's also done his graffiti as well. You know him probably because you've seen a very famous image now around Miami. It's the smiling orange. It's Obi, and it's in so many places. And it's not just Miami. He has put that in a lot of parts of the world as well. But he's joining us now in studio, and we're just talking about this. This idea of what it's like to be a street artist, and you know, a little bit about the graffiti world and where these folks are coming from and, you know, I guess, you know, what it's like when you're living your life, as you've said, you're tagging or bombing or some of the other things you guys do. We're going to take a quick break, come back, have a little bit more about this conversation, talk about Wynwood and what role that's playing in the street art world and a little bit about your international travel. So we'll have more coming up with Atomic here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and again, I'm joined in studio by street artist Atomic. And again, perhaps his most recognizable work is Obi. It is the smiling orange that you have seen on buildings, walls, freight cars. You've seen in a lot of different places. And it's not just here in Miami. It is now going national and international. He's joining me in studio talking just a little bit about his life and life of a street artist. And, you know, I'm going to post up a little later on our Facebook page. We're on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, a little bit of his work. But I want to know from you as well. You could post up your stories there. You know, what's your experience doing some tagging or bombing? Is, you know, that's what he said. This is what these guys do. You know what? Let me ask you about Obi and where Obi comes from, because this goes back to, this is linked to the old Orange Bowl, isn't it?
Correct.
What happened?
They demolished a place that was sacred to Miamians, and I wasn't happy with it, so I just went.
You took this personal.
Sort of, yeah. Okay. I painted an abandoned building on Golden Glades Interchange, and I kind of did a homage to Obi and to the Orange Bowl and put the year that they built the stadium and then the year that they demolished it along with my name and my friend's name. And
the image that we see now, the Obi that we see now, is that was that the first try you came up with that? How did you get to this image?
Well, it developed over the years. The initial one was taken directly from the Miami Orange Bowl stadium, the mascot. And then I received a cease and desist from the Orange Bowl committee maybe 1 or 2 years into using their logo. And then I started developing what you see today. It, just evolved from that character, but a hand-drawn, more graffiti style or street art-esque.
Is that something that, as a street artist, you want to do? You want to have that one image that is... Look, you have your style of writing and how you whether it's Atomic or anything else that you've written on walls or in different places, but is it important to have that one image that makes you stand out, or just did you just... This is luck. You just came across this.
I got lucky in the sense where I found an image that I stuck with, and I think that might have been my graffiti background. You have your name, you stick with that, and then studying graphic design, you have the logo and, you know, identity and whatnot. But artists could do something else and have a specific style, whether it's brush strokes or a color palette, and that's recognizable. So if you always use a certain color, always paint with a certain style, then you could be noticed for that as well.
You ever found anybody trying to use your image?
I have.
Copy?
Yeah, a lot of people.
So you've sent cease and desist letters.
I have not, but actually I have to a few different clothing companies. It wasn't formal with a lawyer, you know, sending the letter. I didn't, you know, make a request that they stop, but I just contacted them and said, hey, what are you doing? Like, why are you using my image? This is how my living.
Did they stop after that?
Yeah, they stopped.
You've posted this image now in a lot of different countries. You've traveled to a lot of places. You travel because you want to find new places.
Correct.
To put your artwork. How do you pick the places? What are some of the places you've been to?
I've been to South America, Central America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, Canada. I don't know. If I have a connection somewhere or if I see there's a scene developing, I'll go there. But I'll travel anywhere, really. It's fun to just see different cultures and different art scenes and people and try the food and experience something outside of my hometown.
And everywhere you go, somewhere you're going to tag.
For sure.
So then how do you pick a place? I mean, whether it's here in Miami or in another city, how do you find that place? We started talking about this a second ago. I want to know your routine. Like, is it just one day you're walking down the street? Oh, I've got a place. That's it right there. Or are you looking specifically for... Are you creating lists? What are you doing?
Sometimes I have a list. I've made a list before on my phone of locations that I wanted to paint. But I don't have a specific... like requirement for a space. I mean, if it's abandoned, that's cool. Or if it's a high visibility spot, that's cool. But there's no like process to selecting a spot. Sometimes it's just sporadic and I'll just write on something, whether it's a bus that pulls right in front of me or a wall or a sign or whatever.
Say, for example, though, you want to go high. You want to find a place that's up high that you've got to climb to. So it's not just saying, well, I want to go there. Do you have to have a plan?
For sure. Yeah, you have to scout the location, and sometimes I bring my ladder, which can get me like 15 feet, 20 feet in the air, and then I'll be able to lift it up and get to other heights, you know, whether I find a stairwell or I'm already on the outside of the roof or whatever.
And how much equipment are you carrying with you? What are you taking with you?
Just a backpack full of paint, so maybe anywhere from 12 to 24 cans, depending on how large I want to go.
And then I'd imagine you probably do a lot of this, what, at night?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the safest time, I guess, right?
For sure. Early morning.
Are you scouting for security? Do you have watchouts? Do you have people looking out for you, I should say?
Both, yeah. You always want to look out for a security guard or law enforcement, and then having someone watching your back is a good idea. You know, have your headphones on and have them on the phone and tell you when to duck or when to hit the ground or whatever. So,
and you got to be fast, I'd imagine.
For sure.
I mean, because I've seen, like I said, I've gone on and I've seen some of your work online. And look, I'm not the artist. I couldn't do that. I can't imagine how quickly you'd have to do that. Did you ever take on anything that was just too ambitious? Like it was just, you wanted something too big, too high, and you had to just bail?
Yes, I have. Whether it's a... That's happened on freight trains before. I've tried to do the whole train, and then it comes and gets picked up and taken away. I've also started pieces that I couldn't finish. When I first started painting, I had all these really cool drawings in a sketchbook, and I tried to go and paint them, and it wasn't possible. I had to, you know, trace my steps and regress my style and then build up painting with a spray can because it wasn't the same as drawing. But these days, now that I paint the orange and I know what I'm going to paint, I usually finish what I start.
Now, that's interesting what you just said, because you don't just do work with spray cans. You're an artist. You got your own studio. You draw. You work on other with other mediums as well.
Yes.
But, you know, what's the trick in using a spray? How'd you learn to use a spray can? It's not as with a brush or a pencil or something that you can control. Spray cans, it's more challenging.
Yeah, it's just a matter of practicing, like anything. At first, it's very difficult, but when you practice and get comfortable with the tool of a spray can, it's pretty easy. But when I paint canvases smaller than 4x4, I'll use paint markers. So sometimes I'll lay down a first coat of spray paint, and then I'll come back with paint markers. And paint markers I used are made by the same companies that make the spray paint, so it's very similar to using a can, just a little less.
Do you remember the first time you got arrested?
Yes, I do.
What were you doing?
I was tagging. We tagged a dumpster at Dadeland Mall by the parking garage, and then Metro Dade police apprehended us maybe like less than a mile away, and I didn't go to jail. They took me to Station 5, and my parents came and got me.
But do the police, do people, I mean, come on, you're known now. You can't really do that anymore, can you?
I still do, and I need to stop. So, yeah, I mean, I look at writing my name and bombing as a form of advertisement, you know.
Right.
As far as street art goes and graffiti goes, you're not going to place an ad on a billboard or on a bus stop or in a magazine. You go out and you put your name up, you put your logo up, and it's a form of advertising for me.
But one of the things that's changed for you is that, and I met you a few years ago, you know, is that you're a dad now.
Yeah.
Changes the whole game, doesn't it?
It does.
So you have to be more careful.
Correct. Yeah, I've had to slow down for sure. I don't go out painting all the time, every night. Actually, we used to live in Brickell in the city. And then when we got married and got pregnant, we bought a house in the suburbs. So now I'm, you know, 30 minutes away from the city. So it's not as easy as just stepping outside of my apartment and going and painting. I have to commute now to the city to paint. But yeah, I definitely need to chill out and not paint and not put myself or my family at risk. You know, I need to be there.
So I want to say, by the way, and I'm curious what you think about this, but I have to say, this is a fascinating conversation, though I do want to say to the audience that, you know, we're not condoning this kind of behavior. We're not condoning going and tagging and hitting a place that you shouldn't hit. But, I mean, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about when every now and then you do hit a place and it belongs to somebody? It's property that belongs to somebody else. And you said there are certain places you won't go, but there are other places, and it's somebody's property.
Right.
And some people like it, as you said, but there are people who are like, hey, come on, man, you're defacing this.
Right. I don't feel a particular way about it. I feel bad, I guess, sometimes.
But you still do it.
I still do it. You know, it's just something that it's a habit. It's an addiction, to be honest. You know, I'll write in all sorts of different places, and it's yeah, it's definitely habit forming and addictive.
You are working on a new project right now, and it's not, you know, it's actually, you were invited to do this. You and a number of artists were invited. It's the actually a new luxury residential building, right? Literally across catty corner from this studio,
right?
The Canvas. And you and some other artists, you've been invited to do what? You're painting, you're doing your art on their walls.
No, well, there is a series of artists that are painting in the, I believe in the elevator area, but yeah, Crave contacted me to take part in the project, and I painted for, I don't know if it was an unveiling or like a groundbreaking party or whatever. I painted a mural on their sales office, and then I painted a canvas, which will be somewhere. I'm not quite sure where they'll place the canvas. So my involvement with that project is just one canvas at this point, because eventually the sales center will be knocked down. The mural will be destroyed.
So what's next for you? I mean, as you said, it's interesting. You said it's a little bit of an addiction. You have to keep doing this on, again, the tagging, as you say. But, you know, you're still also building yourself up as a serious artist. But what else is next for you? What's the next big challenge?
The next challenge is sculpture. Taking my character and having it in 3D. So I've had a few people that I've worked with develop sculptures. One was digital and one is out of styrofoam that I'm going to paint soon. But I want to get into sculpture myself, because there's, you know, there's a loss in translation when someone else creates my character. So really it's just, I guess, stepping into a different realm. It's difficult for me to do it because I'm always painting and just two-dimensional, but what's next is sculpture and you know, vinyl toys or resin toys or maybe even cartoons or something. I don't know. That's something that could be in the future, but yeah, sculpture is next on my agenda.
He is Miami artist Atomic. Again, you've seen his work. It's all over the city, and you've seen his most recognizable image, Obi, the smiling orange. Atomic, man, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
All right.
All right, still to come, we're going to take a look at the Florida Supreme Court making history again. They are now streaming their hearings on Facebook Live. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In the 1970s, the Florida Supreme Court decided to televise its cases. That was a first in the nation. They did it again this year when they decided to start live streaming their hearings on Facebook Live. They started back in February, and we spoke with Chief Justice Jorge Labarga about why the justices decided to take this route and whether other courts will follow. Chief Justice, when did the idea for the court to stream live on Facebook even come up?
Well, as you know, the Florida Supreme Court has had the policy to be as open and transparent as possible. And as you know, we were the first in the nation to televise our oral arguments. And my view and the view of our court is that the more people see how we do things, the more legitimacy our rulings have. And I think that goes for all of government. And Florida has always been a very strong state in that regard, in making sure that people see how their government operates. The whole situation with social media and Facebook, that is the wave of the future, obviously. Most people today look at their iPhones, and that's how they get information. And when I'm not in my office and when I'm not home, that's how I get my information. I don't need to go anywhere without my iPhone. And that's where I get my emails. That's where I get my news. That's where I get everything. And we wanted to make it as convenient as possible for people to see what we do. And so we've been talking about it for quite some time. And as you know, Craig Waters is our public information officer and has been the public information officer at the Supreme Court for a great number of years. And he has been a great innovator in the area of transparency in making our court as accessible to people as possible. So he has been working on this for quite some time. So that made it possible. And, of course, the court is all behind it. And we, as you know, we just did our first one. And from what the response I'm getting, at least from people I know who are calling me and telling me, hey, we watched you on our iPhone. And that was a tremendous first time. So that's where that came from. And what we want to do is we want to keep up with technology in making our court accessible to the public. So today is Facebook. God knows what it will be, 5 years from now. And when that happens, we'll go there. And as long as we keep getting the funding and for it, we'll keep trying to make us as easily accessible as possible.
I wanted to go back to, I guess, that first conversation when it was brought up. I mean, when you first heard of the idea, what did you think?
Well, when I first heard of it, I said, great. I mean, that is wonderful. People may not have time to watch television, or people may be at their offices or in their cars traveling someplace or at the airport. You know how much time I spend at the Atlanta airport waiting to connect flights, and I can sit there and watch oral arguments. Lawyers do that all the time. It's just a great idea that, of course, I and the court jumped on it right away.
The first one, as you said, just happened recently. I believe it was February 7th. And I think from what I read, the first case was about the red light cameras. You're used to cameras in court. What was it like that first day? Did you even think about it?
Well, bear in mind that I came from the trial courts in Palm Beach County. So I am quite used to cameras in the courtroom. That's never been a problem for me. I don't even see them there. And in our courtroom, the cameras are already built into the facility, so we don't even see the cameras. And the lighting is there, so we're quite accustomed to that. I wish all courts would follow suit. I travel around the country. I'm involved with the Chief Justices Conference from Chief Justices from the other 49 states, and not all states have this. The federal courts, as you know, don't have this. So I'm very proud of our state. I'm very proud of my predecessors here in this court that had the foresight to have this done, and I think it's my responsibility and hopefully the responsibility of every other chief to make sure that we keep up with technology to make this court as accessible to people as possible.
I wanted to know if other justices, other courts around the country are asking you any questions about this, or are they just watching you to see how this works that maybe they would do the same thing someday?
Well, they're asking, and they're calling Craig Waters, asking them how we're doing this, how much effort goes into it and how much work and the expense, obviously. But other states are very interested in what's going on here in Florida. And they have been interested since we started televising our courtroom proceedings, especially at the Supreme Court level. Yeah, they're very, very interested in what we're doing here in Florida.
Do you think that all courts should be required to stream live and give the citizens the opportunity to see the process?
If I was king, that's what would happen. That's what would happen. You know, we have here at the Supreme Court of Florida, we enacted a communications plan which encompasses social media and to make sure that we keep up with social media. We just had a few months ago, actually, we had a huge hurricane come through Florida. And what happens when hurricanes come around, power lines go down, phone lines go down, everything goes down. And actually, social media allow us to communicate with each other during those times to make sure that we kept our judicial system open People were getting arrested left and right for looting and whatever, and they're still entitled to see a judge within so many hours. And that's how we kept things moving. So it's a blessing, and it's something that everybody should embrace.
Why do you think the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't do it, and do you think they should?
The only thing I know about that is what I read in the paper. And what I've read in the paper is that they feel that justices will act differently on the bench if they knew that they were being televised. That has not been the case with us. It has not been the case with me. In fact, I don't even realize many times that the cameras are there. Even down at the trial court level, where you know they're there because they're setting up the cameras in the courtroom, you can actually see the cameras. Even there, after the first initial reaction to them, when you see them, the judges forget that they're there. And we just act. I just don't think it has any effect. It never had an effect on me, I can tell you that. But that, from what I read in the paper, that seems to be the fear that they have, that justices on the bench will react, will act differently.
I read something about you and why this transparency is so important to you. It's because of your heritage, your background, and you feel that it's dangerous if a government isn't open in its processes, isn't transparent to the people.
You know, I came from Cuba when I was 11 years old, and a lot of things happened back in 1961, 62, 1960s when I came here, and that are just completely, you know, etched in my brain. What Fidel Castro did is what all tyrants do when they take over. The first thing they do is they abolish the press, and they put in the press they want. So now people get to read and hear what they want them to hear and read. And the second thing they do is they abolish the judicial system and put in their own judges to do their own type of justice. Those are the first two ingredients of a dictatorship. And I think the more people see how things are done, the more legitimate the judicial system is. And once you abolish the press and once you abolish people's access to information, and that's how tyrants rule. So if I was king, you know, freedom of the press and a judicial branch of government that's independent, that would be the rule of the day.
I wanted to ask you quickly about just social media in general and your take on whether or not justices should be on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or anything.
Well, let me just say this. We have a case coming up from Miami on that very issue right now. So I'm not at liberty to discuss that. But obviously, that said, it is obviously an issue of major importance to judges and lawyers around the state right now. So I suspect that we may be deciding that case in the next year or so, and we'll see what happens at that time. At this time, I don't think I better talk about it.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be following up on that then. I'll finish with this. Chief Justice, what do you hope that comes from this this experience? And again, you kind of did touch on it, but just what you hope that the citizens of Florida will get out of this experience, it'll be better for them?
What they will get from it is information, and they will see how the system really works. And they get to see the judges in action. They get to see who they are, you know, how they behave in court, and more information about the cases that they're hearing. Some people tune in when it involves a case that they're interested in. It could be any of these, you know, hot button issues that people think about. And they will see how hard we're trying to get it right. And that is one of the things about being a good judge. I mean, people not understand that you may rule against them, but as long as they understand that the judge gave it his or her all to try to get it right. And once, if people at least leave the courtroom, even though they have lost, and they can say, you know what, I lost, the judge is probably wrong, but at least he tried or she tried really hard to get it right. And I need them to see that, how hard we try in this branch to get it right.
And again, that was a conversation that we had with Chief Justice Jorge Labarca talking to us about the Florida Supreme Court posting their hearings now on Facebook. That's the end of the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, and on iTunes. Download the podcast. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.